My name is Ralph White, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ralph. Hi, Ralph.
Thank you, Mr. C. It's an extreme privilege and honor to be asked to come out anywhere. So I want to thank the committee. Dick was talking about he doesn't know of any other conference like this anywhere. I don't. It's a long time, you know, and I'm the kind of guy, you know, I like overdoing stuff. That's, you know, anything worth doing is worth overdoing. You know, that's what I used to say, you know. And so the idea of a conference that stretches from Sunday to Friday, I'm like, oh, okay, I'm with that, you know. And but beyond that, that's not what really makes this conference unique, though it is. I've never experienced the kind of diligence that this committee shows. You guys don't know. You're sitting out there, you know, and for a couple of years, Carol, Ellen, you know, Sarah, diligently, checking up, following up. Then I get letters from different people. Then my host check up on me, and I'm like, wow, what is this that I'm, you know, and I don't know if it's true or not, but if it's not, don't tell me. You should make a brother feel special. You know what I mean? And I appreciate it. Don't know, since people travel such a large distance to get to this conference, I really don't know if we have any new friends out there tonight. But I'm hopeful that there is somebody looking for a new way of life. I'm hopeful that there's somebody sitting out there that's looking for a way up and a way out. I'm hopeful that there's somebody sitting out there who, if you're sitting out there and you came in here in the condition I did, if you've ever drank like I drank, felt like I felt, done some of the things I've done, this is probably the best step you can take from the cradle to the grave. And that's not something I say lightly. I don't say it because I'm behind a podium. I don't say it because it's the right thing to say when you get behind a podium in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't say it because it's what everybody else says in Alcoholics Anonymous. I say it because this program, this process, and this power I've been introduced to has been working in my life like nothing else I've discovered. When I go to a gathering like this, and I like to say, you know, I stand on the wings of giants. You know, I'm in the spotlight. I'm doing what's the spotlight work in Alcoholics Anonymous right now. Everybody's looking at me. I'm the speaker. I get to sit in the front row tomorrow night. And, you know, that's the out front kind of stuff, you know. But I am forever grateful to the people who stand in the back. And I know the room is full of the people like that. I call them the shadow soldiers. In our program of recovery, you know, our program is represented by a logo that we lost. Don't trip off that, the whole copyright deal. But it's a triangle and a circle, you know. And that triangle has three sides: unity, recovery, and service. Unity is the fellowship, and I bring my body to the fellowship. Recovery, represented by the 12 steps, and that treats my mind. And I take that recovery spirit, and I put it in the service. And those are the service, you know, the service soldiers, the junkies. If you really want to take your recovery to another level, I call them the shadow soldiers. They are the people who toil and they sit on, you know, at these meetings and they argue with each other and they set stuff up and they follow up with phone calls to me, you know. They're the people who fire up a coffee pot on a Wednesday night when they have something better to do. And they go sit and they open up a meeting and they wait for Ralph White to show up. They're the people that on Super Bowl Sunday, they get up anyway, and they stick the key in the door, and they fire up the coffee pot, and they wait for Ralph White to show up, you know. And if you really want to taste what recovery really is, if you really want your life to go to another level, you know, service. You know, so my hat is off to the shadow soldiers that's sitting in the group right now, the ones who kept the light on for a drunk like me. And when I get in a gathering like this, room full of giants, you know, I've had the opportunity to listen at some of the discussion meetings and some of the workshops. You know, I see Mr., you know, Jerry Jones sitting out here, and Dave, they've been doing this for longer than I've been sober. And, you know, I need to let you know who you got standing in front of you tonight. You know, I'm an image guy. You know, I'm style over substance, all front, no back. Ellen likes to quote that. You know, that's the kind of guy, you know, that's the kind of guy I am. I've never been interested in being honest. I just like to convince you I'm telling the truth. You know, that's me, you know. That's who I am for real, you know. And so when I get in a spot like this with all you guys sitting out here that I know are familiar with the program of recovery, you know, I really want to impress you. I want to drop some page line references on you, let you know I know the book, you know. I'm tempted to say I'm not going to share a long drug along. I just want to share about recovery, but I remember being new to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember sitting out in the group, maybe like somebody sitting out in the group tonight. And I remember listening to a speaker who was standing up in front of the group, somewhat like I am, dressed pretty nice, hair comb, eyes bright, stringing sentences together real well. And I remember thinking to myself that night, I know this cat ain't been where I've been. I know he ain't felt what I felt, and I know he ain't done what I've done. What can this lame tell me? So it's real important that I let you know that the man that's standing in front of you tonight is not the same one that stumbled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous October 11th, 1986. I'm going to share with you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today in the hopes that somebody sitting out there might be thinking like I was thinking. Man, I used to feel the same way. I used to do the same things. Or more important, I too want to have this thing. Quick bio, grew up in South Central Los Angeles. I grew up in the heart of Watson, one of six boys. We stayed in a little two-bedroom apartment. Moms and pops stayed in one room. Six boys stayed in three bunk beds in the other room. Earliest memory of my old man was he was an alcoholic, and I didn't want to be like him. My father wasn't abusive, and my father wasn't violent. My father was an absentee drunk. And every other Friday, like clockwork, you knew he would not show up with a check. Be a kid in the neighborhood who would feel like it was his duty to come inform my family how my old man had performed up at the pool hall the previous Friday or Saturday night, and I would feel ashamed and embarrassed, and those are feelings I'm familiar with from a real early age. Pops got put out when I was 8 or 9 years old, and Moms proceeded to raise six boys by herself. Now, when you're grown, you get something that's called perspective, and perspective works like this. You got a mom that raised six boys by herself. Old Southern Baptist sister. She was on welfare at the time, you know, and she raised these six boys. And she put herself back through high school, and she put herself through college, and she worked two jobs, and she took in clothes that she washed and ironed for other folk. And when you're grown, you look back on your life and say, damn, I had a hell of a mom. Look how she sacrificed to raise her boys. But when you're a kid about 9 or 10 years old, and you're coming home from school with a couple of partners on a Wednesday afternoon, and you hit the front door and Moms is in the living room with her ironing board up and a rag on her head, you don't feel proud. You feel ashamed and embarrassed. And if your name is Ralph, you start living in that prison I've lived in much of my life. Prison I live in sometimes even today. And that's the prison of what I think you think about me. See, I don't know what you think about me, but I'm trapped in what I think you think about me. And I will do whatever it takes to shape and form and mold your opinion of Ralph. I'll whine you, I'll dine you, I'll woo you, I'll con you, I'll bully you, I'll manipulate you, I'll buy you. Please like me. Now, I don't particularly have to like you, but please like me. Don't get confused about the proceedings right now. Somebody probably thinking, this guy might be all right speaker. Look at him looking around the room, making eye contact with everybody. I'm looking for the person whose attention is drifting. Look like you going to sleep. I'm going to work on you. You will like me before this is over with, right? Trapped in what I think you think about me. And to our new friends, there are a couple of common themes for members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you'll hear a lot of our members share them when they get behind the podium. And one of the themes that you'll hear from a lot of our members is they never felt like they fit in. And that's not a part of my story. I'm a little guy. I like a lot of attention. I've never been interested in fitting in. I've always wanted to stand out. And as a result of that, I achieved and I accomplished some stuff in life. I don't want you to misunderstand my story when I told you I'm a poor kid from the, you know, from South Central Los Angeles. That's not why I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, you know, the fact that I grew up with and grew up without a daddy in the house, somebody in here who grew up with both parents. You know, the fact that I grew up and we didn't have no money, somebody in here grew up with a silver spoon. I'm not an alcoholic because I'm a little guy. There's plenty of big guys in here. I'm not an alcoholic because I'm a brother from the hood. Look around the room. You know that ain't the reason. You know. You know. I'm not an alcoholic because I'm a man. This room is full of women right now. I'm an alcoholic for two reasons and two reasons only. One, when I take one, I can't tell you when I'm going to stop. Two, when I sincerely don't want to pick up again, I start again anyway. I'm bodily and mentally different. That's it. That's all. The rest is my story, and my story goes a little bit like this. Every single one of you had me in your classroom. I was usually class president or student body president. I was a straight-A student. I was teacher's pet. I played ball. I made all-stars. On the outside, I should have been okay. On the inside, I've always felt like if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. Yeah, I was teacher's pet. Yeah, I was a straight-A student. I would have traded it all in if I just could have been cool. If I just could have been cool. Because the cats who were cool, you know who you are. You in here right now. The ones, you know, in the bathroom, smoking cigarettes, shooting dice, taking quarters from guys like me that brought extra quarters, you know, and you knew how to talk to girls. And girls were a mystery to me. You know, so I'm growing up because in the neighborhood I grew up in, it was a whole lot more currency placed on cool than on smart. You know, if I just could have been cool. So I'm growing up, and I'm growing up at a turbulent time in this country. I'm growing up in the 60s, you know, and it was a changing time, and it was a lot of stuff going on, and I was determined to be bigger and better than my daddy. I was determined to make something out of my life. I was determined that I would do something and I would be somebody, and I was really active in my community, and at all costs, I'm not going to be my daddy. So I didn't touch anything. I didn't touch anything. I'm a late bloomer in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I got a home group at home, and it's in the heart of society. And it's kind of one of them hard home groups, you know. And it took me a while before I found my niche up in there. Because Alcoholics Anonymous is the first place I came where folk try to out-bottom each other, you know. And I didn't feel like my story meant, you know, I got started late. I wasn't going around, you know, drinking out of my parents' cups when they had parties. Because even though I suffer from the effects of alcoholism because I had an alcoholic dad. I never saw alcohol in my house. My father drank away from home. He got put out when I was pretty young in life, and my mom never drank. So I never saw active alcoholism in my house, but I was definitely affected. You know. So anyway, I'm growing up, and I'm not going to be, you know, I'm not going to be my daddy. And so I'm this young dude. Now I'm a late bloomer. I have not touched anything, and I'm not going to. So I turned 16, still haven't touched anything. This square dude, nerd, you know, and I haven't touched anything. I get a girlfriend. At 16. Now, Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 don't mean the same thing it means for some of you cats. Ralph with a girlfriend, 16 simply means this. I ran with a crew of dudes that went with the same group of girls. One of my boys broke up with this girl. I waited a little time to pass, and I told my other boy, look, I want to go with her. He went and asked her, came back and told me, she said, yes, now I got a girlfriend. Right? But I don't know what to do with girls because Ralph don't do girls. Remember them old rotary phones? Yes, I'm a veteran. Them old rotary phones? This is my official girlfriend. If you ask her who do you go with, she would have said Ralph, right? That's the cold thing about this. I had other girlfriends before, but this one actually knew she was my girlfriend. Right? More rotary phones, I would call my girl, and that seventh number would come around and seem like it would come back in slow motion, and Tara would say to you, gotta talk, it's the telephone, right? And I just hang up on my girl, click, because I didn't have no conversation for her. This particular night, I went out on a double date with an older partner of mine. Him and his girl were sitting in the front seat, me and my girl were sitting in the back seat. He was driving. We went to a drive-in movie. Plastic cup of rum and coke came to the back seat this particular night. Drank that rum and coke down, and went down real warm, rushed back to the top of my brain. All of a sudden, Ralph's hand started doing things they had never done. Mouth started saying things that it never said, and I had arrived. Alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Gave me the courage to do and to be and to say things I wouldn't do, be and say without it, and I liked it. I liked it a lot. The big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about me in lots of places, and it starts talking about me in the front, in the doctor's opinion. There's a line in there that jumped out at me the first time I saw it. Men and women like me drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. Recognized the first time I saw it. I was rolling with this older dude. He seemed a whole lot older. He was about 19 or 20. I'm 16. We used to go to some of them domino parties and car parties, and he'd sit around with some of them old veterans. They'd be drinking that scotch, and I'd be scrunching my face up. Ooh, but I like what he did when it went down. I'm not overnight alcoholic. I understand we talk about this disease being progressive in nature because that's how it showed up for me. That first night I drank, I didn't get pissy drunk. I didn't throw up all over myself. I didn't make a fool out of myself. You know, I got a warm, tipsy feeling. I kissed and licked and sucked on my girl in some places I had never done before. You know, and my drinking stayed that way for a time. I would drink to go out on parties, you know, on the weekend. I graduated from high school in 1971, and I graduated to higher education in every sense of the word. 71, I was still just drinking to go out to parties on the weekend. By the end of 71, I was drinking not only at the parties, but I was getting ready during the day on the weekend to get ready for the party. By 1972, I'm drinking not only on the weekends, but I'm drinking after class during the week. By the end of 72, I'm drinking, and now I've added some non-addictive marijuana to the mix. By 1973, I'm drinking, I'm smoking herb, I'm selling herb, I'm doing other drugs, I'm doing it on a daily basis, and you couldn't have told me it was anything wrong with the way I was living. The Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about at a certain point in my drinking career, I won't be able to tell the truth from the false. And the way that that worked for me is this. Isn't the way that I'm doing it? Isn't that the way everybody does it? Why would you be young with a bright future, with a little bit of money? I was getting financial aid. Didn't chasing women and getting low to come with the territory? In those days, man, if you came over to my house and I couldn't offer you something to drink or something to smoke, I wasn't being a good host. And if I went over your house and you didn't do the same for me, not only weren't you being a good host, wasn't coming over your house no more. For what? We have nothing to discuss. You know, I'm glad I grew up at the time I grew up. No disrespect to our young friends. Not talking about new friends, young friends. I'm glad I grew up at the time I grew up. You know, I came up in an era where it was free love. You know, I came up in that era and in that time. And even though it was a lot of stuff going on in the late, you know, in the late 60s and the early 70s, it was a turbulent time. It was a changing time. But in some ways, it was a simpler time. In 2010, you got to worry about safe sex, sexually transmitted disease. You got to worry about AIDS. Man, back in those days, I'd go to a club, I'd have a one-question interview for a girl. You get high? If not, next, I don't need to know your sign. I don't need to know your last name. You need to know your mama's name. Let's get to the basis of this relationship. Do you drink like I do? You know, that's the way I was rolling, man. You know, and Bill Wood, so I'm at this major university. You know, check this out. And I'm at this school, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, that life was stretching out in front of me. You know, Bill Wood, let me go over here for a minute, then I'm going to come back. I'm going to veer off for a second. I came to the program four times before I came to stay. And this is how I would do the program. I would go to a meeting like we're at tonight. I would listen to a speaker share, and I would pick out the most profound things to me that speaker shared, right? I would go to a meeting the next night. I would repeat, but make sure he's not at the meeting and not too many of you guys. I would repeat what he said. I would tack on and keep coming back, and I thought if I claimed it from the podium, it would be true in my experience, and I kept getting loaded. Kept getting loaded. I couldn't find myself in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't find myself in any of you guys' stories. It's a lot of paradoxes in the program Alcoholics Anonymous, and there are a lot of thin lines. And it's a thin line between comparing and identifying. And I was always comparing myself in people's stories, and I could never find myself. And this last time I came back, somebody taught me how to read the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, Ralph, the same way that you read the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous is the same way that you listen to our members tell their stories when they get up here at the podium. When you read the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous and when you listen to our members share their stories, ask yourself three or four questions. Ask yourself, did I drink like he drank? Did I think like he thought? Did I feel like he felt? Or did I do what he did? And when I read the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, when I read Bill's story and when I listened to you guys in the light of those questions, I found my story. You know, because when I would use it, I used to read Bill's story and I saw all the differences. Bill was an older white guy. No, we don't have that in common. You know, Bill was a Wall Street stockbroker. Check out the way I handle money. Bill was a veteran of foreign wars. I'm a Vietnam era draft dodger. You know, Bill in his story talked about there had been no real infidelity. Missed me on that one too, you know. So it was a lot of differences. But when I came back and somebody taught me how to read this story, I found my story. I was at this major university. I was rolling with cats who later on were going to be business and political leaders in my town and in my state and in this country. Cats who were going to be professional athletes, business leaders, and captains of industry. And I was going to be right with them. And just like Bill in his story talked about, the drive for success was on. I'd prove to the world I was important. And that was me. And just like him, he said, drink was taking a more important and exhilarating part in my life. That was me. He went on to say something else that was me. I don't talk like Bill. Bill said something like this. He said, from this alloy of drink and speculation, from this combination of my drinking and my thinking, I would later forge a weapon that would turn on me and cut me to ribbons like a boomerang. I don't talk like that. You know, I talk like my grandma. My grandmother had a shortcut way of saying it. She said, trouble always start out like fun. You know, and that... Trouble always started, and that was me, because it was big fun. You couldn't have told me. You know, you could not have told me. You know, and so I go out and I get through school and I come out of school some kind of way, start working as a counselor for LA City Schools, even though I had the kind of job that should have allowed me to acquire what normal people acquire. I never did that. Snapshot of Ralph's life, this is when alcohol was working. I buy a car, make exactly three car payments, then come find it. I'm fine. First time I had a car repossessed, I had the nerve to call LAPD. I'm 9 months behind on the car note, mind you. I called LAPD. Somebody came and stole my car. They looked at me. No, Mr. White, the rightful owner just came and picked up their stuff. You know, next two times I didn't even trip. I already knew, you know. I'm the kind of brother that never had a problem balancing my bank book. Payday, I got money. 2 days later, broke. Zero. No problem balancing my bank book. I stayed in the crib from 1976 to 1979 without paying rent. A couple of baffling features about the disease I suffer from, and one of them is this. I can't see my relationship with alcohol until I'm free of it. I can't see what it's doing to me when I'm in the mix. So some of the things that are crystal clear to me now, looking in the rearview mirror of experience, were not at all clear to me when I was going through them. One fact stands out real clear to me about the days when I thought alcohol was working. I used to go to work for 2 weeks to live for 2 days. That's it, that's all, a little party. And I can't tell you the day or the hour, can't tell you where I was or what I was doing. When alcohol ceased to be a luxury for me and became a necessity, I can tell you that it did happen. I'm one of the ones that made it to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I played a regret game in Alcoholics Anonymous. If only I knew then what I know now, I never would have took that year right. Remind me of a story I like to tell. A story about a little boy named Johnny. Johnny had a habit his father frowned on. Johnny used to like to play with himself. Father goes off to work, comes home early one day. Little Johnny's bedroom door is closed. Father opens the door without knocking. Sure enough, little Johnny's in the bedroom masturbating. Father looks at him and says, "Son, I thought I told you if you keep doing that, you'll go blind." Little Johnny looked at his daddy and said, "Well, Daddy, can I just do it till I need glasses?" And that reminds me of... That story reminds me of me in the life. I see you going down, you going down, I'm just going to do it till I need glasses, you know. And the book talks about seeking the Lord Companion. It wasn't long before I became the Lord Companion. And I don't have enough time to tell you all the things that should have been signs along the way that I was having a problem with this thing called alcohol. I got married on a Saturday afternoon in April in 1980. I had a bachelor party the night before my wedding. None of the guys at the bachelor party are getting married the next day. All of them have sense enough to go home at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm still at my bachelor party till 7:30 in the morning, me and my brothers, right? Four of us eventually made it to the program. You know, I'm at the bachelor party, and they pour me in the bed at 7:30, and they give me up at 10 o'clock for my 1 o'clock wedding. I'm tore up. I'm just laying on the bed. You know that deal when the bed is rotating and you're just trying to hold it still? I'm laying on the bed, and I'm tore up, right? I'm supposed to say my own vows at this wedding, so I show up the next day. And my then wife-to-be looked at me staggering and wobbling up in there. She said, "Scratch the own vow, say the regular on him," right? So now my lines are cut to two words. We get into the ceremony. We get into the ceremony. It gets to me, I get right out there. I sat there and threw up all over. Passed out. Have not taken a wedding picture to this day. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We got anybody in here that's new? If you're anything like me, when I hit the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I recognized most of the words you guys said at the meetings, but the way you guys used them was not the way I used them in my everyday walk around vocabulary. You guys were talking about a psychic change and this phenomenon of craving and this allergy of the body. And I needed some help with all those. But the first time I heard pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, didn't need no help with that one. Folk like us don't need a dictionary for pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I lived pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization up close and personal, and I lived it over and over and over and over again. See, because I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember sitting on my living room couch. Wife coming out the bathroom real fast, pulling her pants up, going to the dining room table, picking her purse up real and clutching it real close to her as she went back to the bathroom. And I feel this tall because nobody was in the house but me and her. But it got like that in my house. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember coming home and sticking my key in the door. Wife and two-year-old daughter, they both sitting there crying. I look over here and homeboy sitting in my seat with a gun pointed at my stomach talking about I want my money. right now. Fellas, let me talk to you for just a minute. Don't know about the rest of you guys, but I always had a lot of fears and a lot of doubts about, do I have what it takes to be a father? Do I have what it takes to be a husband? Because if you're in the life, your track record already gives you your answer, right? Because what's the father's role and what's the husband's role? To protect and to provide, and it's a cold-blooded feeling, fellas. Laying in bed with a woman night after night after night after night. Knowing not only aren't you providing, knowing not only aren't you protecting, you're the one bringing the wolf to the door. See, they came up in my house several times. Each time I pretended to call LAPD. Each time I knew I was playing a game with myself, they told me, you're going to give us our money or we're going to come up in there and get it. I'm the kind of father, and I'm the kind of husband. Remember sitting on my back porch, two-year-old daughter coming outside pulling in my coat. Daddy, daddy, that's my piggy bank. I remember stopping and giving her a little grin. Don't worry, baby. Daddy's going to put some dollar bills in here for this change. And I wasn't raised to be stealing from my daughter. And I wasn't raised to be stealing from my wife. I was an alcoholic with no tools of recovery, and I did what it took to get what I needed to get. First time I hit my wife's purse, if you had hooked me up to a poly, I would have passed when I told you, I'm not stealing this money. I'm taking this $40, and I'm going to replace it before she knows it's missing in a minute, because I don't steal. It's a trip when you're in the life, when you progressive, this disease is progressive, you know, and it's a trip because the lines start moving. First, I don't steal. Then it's, I don't steal from anybody I know. Then it's, I don't steal from my family. Then I know I wouldn't steal from my little girl. So the first time I hit my wife's purse, and I said, I'm replacing this $40 before she knows it's missing, I'm in it. And I went out and I spent that $40, and I came back looking for some more money, and she had moved the purse. And I couldn't believe I'd hit it, so I didn't look for the purse too hard. And I said, I'm going to replace this money before she knows it's missing. Minute. I like these pictures Lee has. Student history. And in December of 1934, this gentleman right over there was in a hospital for the fourth time. Something happened in the hospital this time. And he left that hospital that December of 1934, and something different had happened. Same doctor had been seeing him, and the doctor noticed this time something was different about him. Partner of his had come to see him about a month or two previous. And he shared some things with him that he had learned in this Oxford group. So the guy goes out about his business when he leaves the hospital. 6 months go by and he goes to out of town to handle some business. And the business didn't come off too good. He found himself in a hotel lobby on a Sunday afternoon. And that Sunday afternoon in that hotel lobby, he got thirsty. It seemed like he was standing in the lobby of that hotel and could look right into the bar and could hear the ice clinking. And for the first time in his life, his friend's words came back to him, and he said, I need to find a drunk not to drink with. What a concept. There's a directory in that hotel lobby. We got the benefit of hindsight, so we can look back and see through a series of divine coincidences, but at that time, it was just desperation. Cat starts calling these numbers on this directory. Ran into this lady, one of the calls. A preacher put him in touch with this lady, and this lady was a praying lady. She's part of a prayer group, like my mom was part of a prayer group. And this lady said, I know a lady that might have a husband who's having a problem drinking. Bill Wilson put in a call. He reached Ann Smith. And her husband was in the doghouse because he had been doing like I do, came in off one of them runs. And so Bill Wilson says to Ann Smith, I understand your husband's having some problems. I'd like to come and see if I could sit with him. Dr. Bob Smith says, I'll give him 15 minutes. Tell him to come over tomorrow. Bill Wilson shows up at Dr. Bob Smith's house, and that 15 minutes turned into about a five-hour talk. A couple of months pass, and those two gentlemen set about trying to work with drunks. 2 years, about 40 people were staying sober. It seemed like that New York hustler looked at that doctor and said, wow, look what we discovered. I wonder how we're going to let Ralph White know when it's his turn. And they said, we'll put it in a book. And they put me in that book. That book got published in 1939. I was born in 1953, and I got to you guys in 1986. They put me in that book. was 2 weeks after I hit that wife's purse and said, I'm going to replace this money before she knows it's missing. Same scenario presented. Came home and got paid and gave her some money, went out, got drunk, do what I do, stay out all night. Came back looking for some more money, and that idea of replacing the money didn't even come to mind. Line in that big book describes me to a T. Alcoholic could be unable to recall with sufficient force pain, suffering, humiliation weeks, even days ago. That thought of replacing the money got replaced by a new thought. I said, last time I took $40 and came back looking for some more, and she had moved the purse. This time I'll take all the money out of the purse, and that I don't spend up, I'll sneak it back in the purse. And I was off and running to hit my wife's purse on a regular basis. She was, you know, and I did that. I would do it on a Wednesday, come back on a Monday or Tuesday, did that one too many Wednesdays, came back. Screen door was locked. Note on the screen door, the rest of your stuff is at your mom's house. Suitcase on the porch, I'm put out of my house, I'm now my dad. Over the course of the next year, my five brothers got put out their respective homes. All of us ended up at my mom's house, and we damn near killed her. When I first got put out of my house and went to stay at my mom's house, my ex-wife thought it was something salvageable about this piece of man she married. And she used to bring my daughter over to my mother's house on a Saturday afternoon so we could keep a father-daughter relationship. And I wanted to be a father to my little girl with everything in me. I really, really, really did. I wanted to take my girl to Disneyland and Magic Mountain. I wanted to take her to a movie on a Saturday afternoon. I wanted to walk up the street with her little hand in my big hand and take her to the store and buy her ice cream. I wanted to sit my girl in my lap and read stories to her. I wanted to tuck her in bed at night and get a good night kiss. I wanted to get the look from my little girl that I've seen men this weekend get. The look like, this is my daddy and this is my hero. And the best I could do on those Saturday afternoons was 30 minutes. 30 minutes. Tell my mom something like I'm going to the store to buy Rain some ice cream. I disappear. It'll be Saturday. I sneak back on Sunday night when her mom was picking her up. And on some of them long Sunday nights, I can remember sticking my head around the side of my mom's house, tears flowing. And I see those two heads in the car and those headlights backing out the driveway, and I'd be thinking to myself, there goes my life, backing out this driveway, crying. And I've heard a lot of members share about being scared of dying out there. That's not a part of my story. I was scared I was going to keep waking up to the same old thing. Monday, the same as Tuesday, the same as Sunday, the same as Christmas. Over and over and over again. And I'm so glad God don't make misery comfortable. And on October 11, 1986, I got miserable enough and I got tired enough that I got directed to my fourth program of recovery. I went to the Harbor Life Center on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. 2 days after, they took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that October in 1986, I was in a real bad way. We share our stories in a general way, so it sounds like it was all bad, but at the same time, my alcoholism was progressing. It's a trip. In the workforce, my career was progressing. So in 1985, I rose to the first management position I had ever had. I was working in management in the law department of a major utility company. And I had an office with a plate glass window, and I had about 80 people who worked, you know, for me, and I could look out on the workforce. Unfortunately, the workforce could look in on me. And you have one of those six-day runs, and you do that whiplash thing and look to see if everybody's looking, and that ain't cool. It's a trip. The big book talks about the alcoholic more than most people leads a double life. And it's a cold thing to be one of the, because that's me. I'm businessman by day, and I'm vampire by night. And it's a cold thing because the vampire always overtakes the businessman. The vampire always overtakes the housewife. The vampire, he just outgrows. And the vampire started showing up at work. And they wasn't appreciating that because they didn't pay the vampire to come to work. And pretty soon, only the vampire was showing up at work. And, of course, they asked the vampire to leave. And I had to leave with him, you know. And so I'm out of work, and I'm full-time drinking. So I was in a real bad way, and I had this management position, and I had risen to a part. And so that October in 1986, I was just full of remorse, and I was full of guilt, and I was full I'd never be able to forgive myself for the things I'd done and what I'd become. And guys like me don't get second chances. You know, I was full of that. you know. I've only shared with you the tip of the iceberg, you know. So I was full of remorse and regret. And that gentleman that night at that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was speaking in front of the group, somewhat like I am tonight. And he was sharing about taking from the family, and he was sharing about taking from the job. And I remember looking at him and thinking to myself, yeah, you sharing about doing scandalous things, but you look scandalous. You should have been doing that. I'm different. Y'all ain't going to hear my business. And the speaker seemed like he was reading my mail. He dropped something on me like this. He said, if you're sitting in this room right now, you are not responsible for your disease, but you are responsible for your recovery. And you have just now tapped into a source of power much greater than yourself. And you don't have to drink and you don't have to use no matter what, provided you are willing to fulfill some conditions. And he caught my attention. And that speaker that night went on to say, this is the only club you can be a member of where the worse off you are when you get here, better off your chances of staying. And I got the message of hope at that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He described to me what I suffer from, and he did it in a real strange way. He was talking about me, talking about himself, and never seen anything like it. A lot of people have been talking at me, to me, about me, down at me, but this cat was hitting me where I live, and I had, you know, if you're sitting in here right now, a lot of times we probably got some relapses, and we probably got some people coming back. I'm just sharing with you my experience, you know, and I like to talk about my experience, you know. When I was new, I was in that last time, it seemed like I was taking everything personal, and I mean in a good way. The speaker shared that it was something physically different about me, and seemed like he was talking directly to me. Seemed like he said, Ralph, don't take my word for it, invited me to diagnose myself. How many times did you say, I'm just going to spend 20? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times did you say, I'm just going to stop off at happy hour? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times did you say, I'm going to stop off over at my boy's house for a minute? What happened? Whole paycheck. Ralph, did it happen once? Did it happen twice? If your name is Ralph, every 2 weeks from 1979 to 1985, whole paycheck. My experience, not yours, not my sponsors, not Bill Wilson's, my experience abundantly confirms for me when I take one of anything, no matter where I have to go, what I have to do, who I have to see, no matter how great the wish or the necessity, my body take over and I have to have another. Okay, smart guy, just my body. How do you explain stone sober? My car seemed to drive to the LIQ on payday. Second part of this disease, the mental obsession. The obsession that somehow, someday, I will be able to control and enjoy this magic potion I just got. Somebody help me. Where's this control and enjoy coming from? Check this out. Anytime I was controlling, I wasn't enjoying. Anytime I was enjoying, I damn sure wasn't controlling. Why am I stuck on that? I can't drink because of my body. I can't not because my mind refuses to accept that fact. I'm powerless. Third part of this disease, spiritual malady. 12 and 12 describes it as a soul sickness. And in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, Ralph, if you work on the spiritual, the mental and the physical are straightened out. That's what we do. That's what we do. That's what we do in these rooms. Don't get scared. They tried to say that to me. I said, oh, they're slipping the G word in on me. I know what they're doing. You can't fool me. You know, you can dress it up any way you want to, but I know you're trying to slip that one in on me. But check this out. It's some stuff I learned. We got sponsors in here, and people, how many people work with relapses all the time? Some that just can't seem to get it, and I get frustrated, and I get upset. I don't even trip off that. You know, I don't even trip. And sometimes people come back to the rooms and we applaud and we say, it takes such courage to stand up. It don't take courage. I pray you desperation. I pray you desperation. Because I came back in here in a desperate condition. And those other three times I tried to get sober, I was serious about recovery. I was serious each time. And each time I got loaded again. And this last time when I came back under the last alcoholism, I had another element. This time, not only was I serious, I was committed. Serious is how I feel. Committed is what I do. I was committed to do whatever it took to stay sober one day at a time. You know, and I learned some valuable anatomical facts about me. I learned that when my behind is raw, my mouth closes and my ears open. It's just that when that behind starts healing, mouth starts running, ears start closing. It was raw enough this last time that is long enough for me to hear the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. Long enough for me to hear the music of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I came up in here in a real bad way. Tonight's speaker, I'm not tonight's speaker because I'm the one that's giving you the message of fear. I'm not trying to scare nobody in the recovery, you know. I'm not the one, oh, if you go back out there, you know, I don't know nothing about all that. If you read between the lines, you know I did some of everything. And in what I used to think of as my heyday, people used to look at me the way I was doing it and be like, damn, Ralph, ain't you scared of overdose? I'd be like, scared of overdose? I'm scared of the deadly underdose. You better give me some more, you know. So the message that a whole alcoholic of my variety is not the message of fear. The big book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about a message that's got to have depth and it's got to have weight. And the message tonight speaker brings to you that's got the most depth and the most weight is you're looking at a guy who at 33 years old had given up on life. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old had not answered anybody's 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock wake-up call to go to work in so long, I no longer thought I was employable. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old didn't know where his little girl was enrolled in school and didn't know where his family was living. You're looking at a guy who came from a major university in this country, and my job at the end of my drinking was taking the trash out for a 21-year-old. I was sleeping in the back of my mother's garage, and I was eating lemons off a neighbor's lemon tree for breakfast. And you met me in that condition. And the men and women in this fellowship, the fellowship I crave, you loved me and you nursed me back to health. You gave me a way out upon which we all agree. You said something to me that I found real strange, and I didn't believe it. I didn't believe it. We still say it to new people today. They said, let us love you till you can love yourself. And I didn't believe that one. How you going to tell me you love something like me? If you turn your back on me now, I'm liable to go up in your purse. I stink. How you going to tell me you love something like me? And that was before I knew what takes place in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was before I knew what happens when the God in you reaches out to the God in me. That was before I knew that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we specialize in loving unlovable people. And you loved me back to health. And you gave me something. You talked about some steps. Steps one, admitted that I'm powerless over alcohol, and nowhere in that step does it talk about accepting powerlessness. In fact, a little bit further, it says lack of power. That's my problem. Step one is the problem, and it's a conclusion I draw based on my experience. I don't have to come to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and sit up and ponder and decide, I guess I'll decide that I'm powerless over alcohol. No, alcohol decided that for me. Thank you very much. And I came in here and I listened to you and you and you and you and you. And it snuffed out the last flicker of hope that I could do this by myself. Step one is a conclusion I draw based on my experience. And it is the problem. Step two, the solution, came to believe that a power greater than me could restore me to sanity. And step two is also a conclusion I draw based on my experience. I couldn't stop me. You couldn't stop me. Employer couldn't stop me. Judge couldn't stop me. Little daughter crying couldn't stop me. If it ain't a power bigger than me that could stop me, I'm in big trouble. I took step two out of desperation, and I took step two out of what do I have to lose. Step one is the problem. Step two is the solution. Steps 3 through 12, the 10-step program of action to get me into the solution. Step three, made a decision to turn my will, which is my thinking, and my life, which is my actions, over to the care of God as I understand him. Told my sponsor at the time, how I'm going to turn my will and life over to God as I understand him. I don't understand him. He said it ain't but two things you need to know about God to start this process. Number one, he is. Number two, he ain't you. And from that beginning, all sorts of remarkable things have started happening in my life. In my life. And we don't have enough time for me to share with you all the things that have taken place on this journey of mine. I'm a person that talks a lot about the process of recovery. I'm a person who talks a lot about the steps. I'm a person who talks a lot about all three parts of this program. I'm a person who talks a lot about this fellowship. I'm a person who talks a lot about sponsorship. I'm a person who talks a lot about the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. And more than all those things, more than all those things put together. See, because life come visiting a guy named Ralph. I've been doing this for a minute. And I've been abundantly blessed. And I've been overpaid. I'm one of the ones that don't take it for granted. And I'm one of the ones that's still grateful. I'm still as grateful today as the day I hit the rooms. I'm still grateful that sometime later on this road to recovery, another woman found me worthy. And I got all the way down the aisle this time, and I even had pictures to prove it. I'm still grateful. I'm still grateful that I got a 15-year-old daughter at home. My favorite word. And I called her before I came here. It's my favorite word. Sometimes it's said in exasperation. And sometimes it's said like, wow, you are such a lame. Sometimes it's said, you know, in effect. It said, but she says, Dad. And it gets me. And it gets me. Because I'm one of the ones who used to be the next year, Daddy. I'm one of the ones that on Christmas and on birthdays, I'd be out doing what I'm doing. And some folk look at their watch. I look at the sun and I think to myself, next year I'm going to get that girl something. And as a result of this program and this process and this power, for the last 23 birthdays and the last 23 Christmases and the last almost 24 years of every day in between, I've been this year, Daddy. I left on Sunday morning, and I told my little girl, I won't be back until next Saturday. Here's the miracle. I've never seen the flicker of doubt in that little girl's eyes when daddy leaves. Like, I wonder if daddy coming home. Because she don't know that guy. Daddy's always home. That two-year-old daughter whose piggy bank I was going in. Last Thursday, I was talking to some people here. She called me with my favorite word, too. Daddy, I'm finished. And that little girl called me, and she's a grown woman now. And she had just finished the third day taking the California State Bar Exam. Yay. And the cold thing about it, because I got sober when she was 2 years old. So daddy's been there every step of the way. Every step of the way. Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom, who me and my five brothers damn near killed, a few years back, 5 years ago, gave her a surprise 75th birthday party. Miracle of it is, because my mom is very sharp, we actually pulled it off. At the end of the night when we were reviewing everything, she said, Ralph, because my mom is the oldest of like six siblings, and so she raised their little brothers and sisters. Then she started having babies when she was 17, and she raised all of us. And she said at the end of that night, Ralph, this is the first time I've ever had a party. So on behalf of my mom, I want to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for giving my mama a party. That's Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. So I've had so many blessings along the way. And I'm a brother that stays in. I'm in this deal. I'm in this deal. It has never been hard. You know, I fell in love with the program. I fell in love with the fellowship before I fell in love with the program. And meetings became the high point of my day. And I started doing the deal. I started doing the deal. I started doing the deal. I started doing the deal, and I started doing the deal. And I can't tell you what meeting I could have afforded to miss. I can't tell you what phone call I could have afforded to ignore. I can't tell you what panel I could have afforded to blow off. I can't tell you what meeting I could have afforded to not go to that gave me just enough when the storms come, because they came. I've had three valleys in recovery. And my last valley was a couple of years ago. At 22 years sober, I thought I needed to be in a, I wanted to be in a recovery home. 22 years sober. Because at least when I was drinking, I had an excuse for why my life was looking the way it was looking. 22 years sober, 20-year marriage, gone. House, gone. Money, gone. Everything materially gone, and I'm a material guy. I'm a material guy. And sometime I learn what I don't know about myself. I've been on this road, and I think that I suffer from a condition that only a spiritual experience will conquer. That's what I say with my mouth, because I'm a big book. You know, Hilda was talking about thumping, and I like to talk about that book too. But my belief don't show me that. It don't show me that's what I really believe. Because I thought the evidence of a spiritual life is your stuff. So when my stuff was gone, I felt fraudulent in my sponsorship. When my stuff was gone, I wanted to stop going everywhere talking. When my stuff was gone, I thought that it was something wrong with it. And yeah, I'm a raggedy guy. I live right, you know. Sometimes, you know, and I work with people. My sponsor always says, you know, God's grace is always sufficient to meet the need. Though it might not exceed it, but it's always sufficient to meet the need. You know that saying that sometimes you get tired of hearing people be talking about, you know, God won't give you more than you can handle. That's true, but life will. That's why you need God, and I'm here to tell you that's what it happened to me. You know, and that, so if you're doing this deal and you ain't got the God, you know, I don't know about nobody else, but doing the program without having God up in it is like driving the car without no gas. You're sitting in the car, but you ain't going nowhere. You know, and so I thought you know, because in this long winter of mine, I learned some valuable lessons about myself, because God will change you without your permission, but he does need your cooperation, and he'll change you in the dark, and he'll change you in those places, because every single year I get on my knees with some people, and I say, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me. And imagine that. Imagine that. The peace of man that came up in, and he took me. He took me. And he did something with me. And so my life, wherever it go and whatever direction it go in, it ain't my business no way. Whatever direction it go in, I got out the business of judging good, bad, indifferent. I got out the business of doing that. Because somebody need to know you can lose a marriage and you ain't got a drink. Somebody need to know that the IRS can come after you for $80,000 and you ain't got a drink. Somebody need to know that you can sit up here and lose everything materially and you ain't got a drink. And beyond all of that, somebody need to know that not only can you lose all that, but you can stand up and feel like more of a man than you ever felt like before. God is transformational, and the things I see as problems in my life, God's opportunities for me to grow. And he grows and he uses me, and he got a purpose for everything. See, everybody come up in here, you know, I'm going to talk about this for just a minute. I like talking about my program. I feel like, and I'm not going to stay up here too much longer, but I just want to show you, I want to talk about what he's done in my life. I want somebody in here need to know, because somebody in here feel like they're in a dark place. Somebody in here feel like it's just not no light. Somebody in here feels like, why am I even continuing to go to the meeting? Somebody in here feels like walking out on Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody in here feels like I was feeling. I want to let you know God got a blessing with your name on it. And that's how he uses me, because at the end of that prayer, I say, take away my difficulties. The victory over there may bear witness to those I would help with thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. My sponsor says, Ralph, sometimes you're going to have to be the message you carry. And if the message that you carry is that God can handle anything, guess what? Sometimes you're just going to have something for him to handle. Somebody in here just got something for him to handle. When you're in that dark place, just ask yourself, is it all right right now? See, because I live in my life. I don't live in my life. I live in my head. I live in my head. I don't live in my life. I invite you to live in your life right now. Get out your head. You know, because it's when I live in my head that the problem's overwhelming. If I don't have no money in 2 weeks, forget 2 weeks. While this long-winded brother is up here, it's all right now. While you listening to this guy, is it all right now? And every right now kept being all right. And I would get to the other side and I'd have something that made a value and purpose. If you come from a place of uselessness, hopelessness, helplessness, worthlessness that I come from, if you come from that dark place and you get to come to a fellowship like this and your life gets recreated and you get to walk with a sense of purpose. See, it's three phases of my prayer life and they mirror the phases of my recovery. As I've been listening to the workshops, I've been struck by that. You know, the first phase, almost all of us hit it. We all get here with that first phase. First prayer, help me. God help in some form or another. God help me. Then I get here, and after a time, I go to the second phase. Give me, grant me, grant me pieces. I go, grant me, and then I try. Hopefully, I'm gonna get to that third phase. Prayer life, and my life at Alcoholics Anonymous. Use me. Use me. How dare I go sit at a meeting talking about I'm not getting nothing out that meeting? My sponsor will look at me and what you bringing to the meeting? Hell, you mean you're not getting nothing out to me? You got your life. I'm grateful to have the opportunity to give something back. I'm grateful the light was kept on for a drunk like me. I just want to leave this place a little bit better than I found it. I pray to God, and my most fervent prayer all the time is, make me open to hear when you speak to me. Make me open to see your presence when it's around me. And dude is standing up here doing all this, God, so check this out. Trust me, I ain't a floater. You know, spiritual path, spiritual walk. Spiritual walk ain't floating. Spiritual walk is halting and tripping and stumbling and staggering and moving forward. It was times in that valley. I was crying like a baby one day. I broke down. And I'm not, yeah, I say it's cool for guys to cry at the podium. I still say that, but inside of me, I ain't crying. You know, and I encourage y'all to, but I'm still in that. You feel me? I'm still in that. So, you know, and one day I just broke down and I'm crying, and I couldn't feel God. Couldn't feel him nowhere. Couldn't feel his presence. Couldn't pray. Couldn't get it anywhere. But my faith, you know, if the disease centers in my thinking, don't make the mistake of thinking recovery coexists there too. The disease centers in my thinking. Recovery centers in my action. Always, Aaron always said, you can find disease in my head, recovery in my feet. Train your feet. So I'm crying and the rest of that, but I do what I do. I call somebody. And this is the miracle of it. This is what I found. I'm going to tell you guys something when it gets real dark. Most of you know it. I call somebody, and it's good to call somebody that's plugged in. It's like when on cell phones now, you don't know no phone numbers. If you don't have the name there, you can't call them. I didn't have God on my speed dial, and I called somebody, and thank God they did, and they three-wayed me. They three-wayed me. And it always worked. When me and another alcoholic are talking, seemed like God, he seemed like grace just sitting in the midst. Seem like grace descends upon the conversation. And if you haven't seen, like, don't you want to visit from? And so he three-wayed me. I'm like, damn, you know, and I got it. I got another one. And so I said, God, keep me open to when you talk to me. Let me hear your voice in all my activities. Let me see it, because I'm a raggedy guy and I do what I do. And so I need him real bad. You know, the spiritual walk for me. And that's why I do what I do. And I'm transparent in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how you raise me. What I am is a product of what it is that you raised, you know. And I'm still a work in progress, even right now. So I'm grateful, and I don't miss what it is that we do. There are lots of ripples that come from here. I love seeing the kids walk through here, because every time I go to it, I'm reminded of what really takes place in the rooms. It's not just the transmission of knowledge and information that takes place in here. That's not what's really going on right now. If you think it is, you're missing it. If you think it is, you're missing it. Every time I go to a meeting, I'm going to share with you. Every time I go to a meeting, it's going on right now, me and you. I get to participate in some little boy or some little girl getting ready to have mama come back. Every time I go to a meeting, we're doing it right now, me and you. I get to participate in some family getting ready to have daddy come home. Every time I go to a meeting, right now we're doing it. Get to participate in some family being reunited. Every time I go to a meeting, I get to participate in some man or some woman getting ready to have a hell of a spouse in their house. Every time I go to a meeting, who wouldn't want to be part of a fellowship like that? I always wanted to do something important, and I always wanted to do something significant. And I can think of nothing more important, and I can think of nothing more significant than being a participating member of the life-saving, life-changing experience that is Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're sitting in here right now, I'm very serious about my recovery, but I ain't serious in recovery. If you ain't laughing in this program, you ain't taking this program serious enough. You know, it's fun for me. It's fun. I know exactly why I'm sober. You'll never hear Ralph White say, I don't know why I'm sober. I know exactly why I'm sober. I get a blessing so that I can be a blessing. Recovery for me is a gift from God. What I do with my recovery, that's my gift to God. My name is Ralph White, and I am an alcoholic.